Karen Hartglass, and you are listening to It's All About Food. It is June 20th. Happy summer 2012. Thanks for joining me today, and it's going to be a very interesting program. I am the founder of Responsible Eating and Living. You can go to responsibleeatingandliving.com, and that's where I put up all kinds of information and recipes and videos to make it easy for you to live a plant-based, cruelty-free, environmentally friendly, lovely life. And I like to make it happy and easy for you to do that. So visit responsibleeatingandliving.com when you get a chance. And let me know what you think. You can send me an email at info@realmeals.org. info@realmeals.org. Okay, got that? Great. What do we do on this show? We talk about my favorite subject, food, and how it impacts our health, the environment, and animals. And the most important subject, the most important issue for me when it comes to eating the way that I eat, which is whole and minimally processed plant foods, the most important thing for me is the animals. I became a vegetarian when I was about 15 because I didn't want to kill animals. And I really didn't know what that meant at the time. I was just kind of going with the flow of my instinct. But I've learned a lot more, and a lot more has happened since that time, which hasn't been very good for the animals. So we're going to talk about animals today. And we're going to start with Gary Steiner. I'm really excited to have him on today as my guest, and he's here with me in the studio. He's a John Howard Harris Professor of Philosophy at Bucknell University. He's the author of Descartes as a Moral Thinker, Christianity, Technology, Nihilism, Anthropocentrism, and Its Discontents, The Moral Status of Animals in the History of Western Philosophy, and Animals and the Moral Community, Mental Life, Moral Status, and Kinship. And he's got a new book coming out later this year, Animals and the Limits of Postmodernism. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Thanks very much, Karen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Okay, so you have a lot of interesting information about, number one, how we got here. I think what's going on today is really horrific, especially with factory farming and all the exploitation of animals for primarily for food and other things. And my understanding is it took us about 2,500 years to get to where we are today?
Well, in a way, yes, and in a way, no. The industrialized aspects of it, especially in North America, I think it took about 2,500 years to get to, and you needed a certain set of values that were established in the ancient Greek world, and they sort of developed and reinforced themselves over the ensuing several thousand years, and then you basically needed the development of capitalism and industrialization and so forth, and that's how you get to things like intensive, you know, CAFO, factory farming type operations. But there's a sense in which this isn't really something new, because the ancient Greeks, already as far back as Aristotle and the Stoic philosophers, had this view that human beings are the highest beings in the created world, and that everything else, including all non-human animals, existed and were, in fact, were created expressly to satisfy the needs and desires of human beings. So people as far back as Aristotle, we're talking roughly 400 B.C., argued as a kind of cosmic principle that it's perfectly permissible to use animals and that we shouldn't really have any scruples about doing so, because essentially the idea was this. The highest thing a human being can do, these thinkers thought, and this is something you see in a lot of forms all the way through the history of Western philosophy, is engage in detached, abstract, contemplative activity, contemplating the stars, contemplating the eternal truths, and so forth. And the logic was, okay, the way that you make yourself able to engage in contemplative activity is to satisfy your material needs. And from there, it was a very, very short step to saying, well, okay, everything in the natural world that is not capable of rational contemplation is just an instrumentality to be used by rational beings. And that's how this sort of fundamental division got established between human and non-human beings, where human beings were considered to be the only rational beings in creation, and all non-human beings, including non-human animals, were considered just to be sort of almost inert instrumentalities.
I can go two ways with this, but either way I go with it, I come to the same conclusion. So one of the things that I think about is we say that animals don't think like we do. They don't have the language skills that like we do, but we're learning more and more that that's not true with many animals.
Yes.
And that they don't have this awareness of the past and the future. And I say, how do we know what animals think about? How do we know? And to me, they have so much intelligence that we don't have, that we don't even know how to get to communicate, to learn from them. They do so many incredible things.
It's a very, very interesting fact that is broadly overlooked in our culture, because we're so inured to this idea that we're superior. And the way that we've sort of represented ourselves as superior is by playing to certain capacities that we think that we have or possess exclusively. So rationality, the capacity for abstract reasoning that you see in things like mathematics, the establishment of abstract principles in ethics and politics, the ability to engage in symbol or use symbolic language. And it's as if we seized upon certain capacities that we at least arrogate to ourselves as being exclusively human in order to say that you have to have those capacities in order to be fully morally worthy. And then when we can point out that non-human animals don't appear to have those capacities, it's as if they don't have any other capacities whatsoever. And as you said, we have been learning more and more about the extraordinary capabilities of a lot of animals that make us look a little stupid sometimes.
Absolutely.
Not only in the fact that we can't do a lot of those things, but in the fact that we're incapable of recognizing mm-hmm. those kinds of intelligence on the part of those creatures. So one kind of animal, one group of animals that's very, very interesting is corvids. I mean, everybody thinks about higher primates. But there are several other types of animals that are extraordinarily intelligent and do think about the past and future, it would appear. And you can't be absolutely certain because you can't interview
them
in language that we would take to be, you know, dispositive. Mm-hmm. But there seems to be a lot of very compelling evidence that elephants, dolphins, higher primates, and this group of birds called corvids, which includes crows, ravens, I think minor birds are corvids. But crows in particular have been focused on quite a lot, and they're quite extraordinary in what they're capable of doing, and I think they put us to shame in some ways in terms of what they're able to communicate to their conspecifics, to their fellow corvids or to their fellow crows, in ways we just would not be able to do it. The way they warn their fellow troop members of threats, impending threats and so forth, and the way they all react in a very appropriate way, it's quite remarkable. And there are monkeys called vervets that have an elaborate system of alarm calls. There's at least every time you turn around, you're finding that they've got another one they've discovered. At first they thought there were sort of three, and now they think there are four or five, and it turns out it has to do with whether it's an aerial predator or a ground predator, whether it's a large mammal or whether it's a snake. It could be a martial eagle, and it could be a martial eagle in the air versus on the ground. And there are different distinct calls for each of these types of predators, and the others in the group respond appropriately. They respond in a way that would be, so for instance, if it's something like a large mammal, they run up a tree. And if it turns out that it's something like a snake or something like that, they run into the bushes or something like that, or they run away. And it's quite remarkable, and I think increasingly implausible to suppose that we're the only really smart creatures on Earth.
Well, we're the only ones that are destroying the planet.
It's a good point. It's a good point. And you know, there are philosophers who have said that they've claimed in a kind of anthropocentric, speciesist kind of way.
Can you define that for?
Yeah, anthropocentrism is sort of the core idea of a lot of my work on animals, and it's the idea that human beings are the central and highest beings in the scheme of things. And speciesism is to species as racism is to race or sexism is to sex. Anthropocentrism, speciesism, is this idea that we arrogate to ourselves, as I said before, the position of the highest, most important, most morally worthwhile creature in the world, and we give ourselves prerogatives to use other creatures. So where were we going with that?
Right. Well, you mentioned something about this I can't even say it.
Anthropocentric.
Anthropocentric. Okay.
I lost my train of thought.
That's
there.
Fine. Maybe it'll come
delicious
back.
Vegan lunch that I had a little while ago.
Well, you're in New York City right now, the greatest city in the world, where we have so many vegan options. And, you know, I just, this isn't a commercial break, but I love the fact that the one thing that's wonderful about this lifestyle, and we may get into the fact that it's not just a lifestyle, it's something more, is that the food is fabulous. So while we're talking about all of this heavy stuff, the conclusion is that the life is wonderful once you take it on.
Absolutely.
And delicious.
And I have an interesting anecdote to share, which is that my lovely wife, Paula, who's with us here in the studio, she and I went on our belated honeymoon to northern Italy recently. Mm. And in a restaurant in one of the cities, one of the popular tourist destinations, Venice or Florence, I think it was, we were in a restaurant explaining to the waiter that we don't eat meat and we don't eat butter and we don't eat fish and we don't eat cheese and we don't eat eggs. And he looked at me very quizzically and said, "What do you eat?" And if he only knew, well, what wonderful things
right,
you can eat.
It opens the door.
If you just use a little bit of imagination, and especially, you know, we're so accustomed to wanting to eat processed foods, foods that you can take out of the freezer and throw into a microwave or something. But if you're really willing to prepare whole, fresh food, you can eat very, very well. It's yummy. It's much better for your health, as you know.
We're really getting off the subject here, but this is the subject, food. But you made me think of when I was working as an engineer in the semiconductor industry. I traveled quite a bit, and I went to Milan and worked with a company there. And they were one of my favorite clients to visit because I love their cafeteria. This was Italy, and what they had in their cafeteria, they always had this antipasto available with all of these wonderful grilled vegetables that were always there. And then you could choose pasta or rice and a different sauce, tomato sauce or something else. There was always mineral water on the table and olive oil, and I didn't even have to see any of the other food. It was just incredible.
Yeah, we
so I'm
pretty
surprised
much,
that they said that.
I don't know what the guy was thinking, because then he brought 5 minutes later he brought out a beautiful plate of grilled vegetables.
Oh,
and we pretty much lived on grilled vegetables for 2 weeks.
That's
and so
very
it was really
good.
Wonderful. So what I was saying before, I think, was simply that it's troubling and interesting. What you said was, you know, we're the only creatures that are destroying the planet. And there are philosophers. What I was saying was there are philosophers in this anthropocentric tradition, one that proclaims that human beings are the highest beings, the only really godlike beings in creation. We tell ourselves that we have the right to do all sorts of things to animals and that there are no moral consequences to it at all. There have been philosophers in that tradition who say that only human beings are capable of true moral virtue because a certain amount of contemplation is required in order to achieve that, but then they also tend to acknowledge that only human beings are capable of radical evil for the very same mm-hmm. reason. And that was the point that I think I was trying to make before I got a little addled there, which is I think that if you just look at the way the world is, it's pretty evident that only human beings are able to sort of undertake deliberate harm on such a large scale with you know, deliberate forethought.
Absolutely. It takes my breath away.
Can I ask you a question? Do you know
sure.
the work of Mark Beckoff?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've spoke with him once on this show.
Yeah, he's absolutely wonderful. And he's written a book with Jessica Pierce called Wild Justice. He's written many, many, many books. But he is a pioneer in canid play behavior in dogs, the social structure of communities of animals such as dogs and wolves and so forth. And he's done more than a lot of people in the contemporary generation of researchers to show that, you know, human beings have not cornered the market on not only on intelligence, but on other regarding behavior that expresses concern for others. And there's evidence of altruism in various sorts of animals. And I think many people know the story of that gorilla at that zoo in the United States, maybe in the last 10 years, that somebody's child fell into that pit that separates the gorillas from the spectators. And the gorilla climbed down in there and brought the child out and handed it to the parent and so forth.
There are so many incredible stories if we take the time to pay attention.
Exactly.
What I'm thinking of is the stories we hear about the dogs where a family's either moved away or the dog somehow or other was placed in a place very far away and managed to find either the old home that he lived in or the family who had moved away. And, you know, you can't say that the animal isn't aware of its past when it's so driven to do that and then to figure out how to find them.
Yeah, cats too.
Please.
Yeah.
There's something there that we need to tap into.
And just one other anecdote. I was telling my veterinarian, who's a good friend of ours, one day a few years ago about this claim that, you know, animals don't really have a sense of their lives as a whole and they don't remember their pain and these sorts of, I can only call them excuses that people make because we were talking before the interview about Gary Francione, and Gary Francione has this wonderful idea of moral schizophrenia. That on the one hand, we love our pet animals, and there are certain aspects of animal life that we embrace and love, but on the other hand, we kill, and this is the United Nations number, 53 billion land animals worldwide every year just to eat them, just because they taste good and it's convenient to consume them. It doesn't even count fish or crustaceans or anything.
Yep.
I said to my veterinarian that I've heard people say, you know, only human beings really have a sense of time and the future and the past, and therefore when an animal dies, a non-human animal, it's not really losing anything because it doesn't have can't contemplate the future, doesn't have an expectation of a long future, doesn't really have memories of the past and so forth. And she just looked at me with this angry look and said, spend 5 minutes in any veterinary ER and you will know that animals remember their pain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't doubt it. I was going to say there are more studies coming out now about how we don't just have memory in our brains. We have memory in all parts of our bodies, which is really fascinating to me, and I personally experienced it. And so if we can think in different parts of our bodies, why can't animals think not just in their brains but in other parts of their body? That's a whole other subject. But what I was talking about in the beginning was I had two ways to go with this. And so my second way to go, which brings me to the same conclusion, is whether or not animals do think or have memory or have some moral feelings or whatever, whether they do or not, how is it that we can decide it's okay to inflict pain and suffering?
Yeah, it's a kind of a God complex, I think. You know, I'm often asking myself and others this question. What difference does it make whether they can think about the future or think about the past? The way I put it in my last book, Animals and the Moral Community, was like this. There are people who say that human lives matter more in the cosmic scheme of things than animal lives because those lives matter more to their possessors. And I absolutely reject that claim. What I argue in Animals and the Moral Community is that our cat Pindar cares about his life every bit as much as either any of the humans in this room care about their lives, which is to say, to an incalculable, non-quantifiable degree. It's a kind of an infinite regard for one's own life. And, you know, when love and other regarding conduct works correctly, it's possible to have that kind of infinite concern for another. I don't think that the fact that we can think about our lives or think about our futures means that our lives matter any more than the life of my cat Pindar. The problem that a lot of people have with that kind of reasoning is we're so accustomed to thinking of human life as obviously worth more than animal life that people start to try to pigeonhole me and say things like, look, if it were really your life, your wife's life, or the life of your cat, which would you choose? Again, I got to appeal to Gary Francione, who is the most lucid thinker in animal rights in the contemporary generation. I think he's really, really remade the landscape of animal rights thinking. And is his book, Introduction to Animal Rights, the subtitle is Your Child or the Dog.
Right.
And it's it seems like you're familiar with this. The idea is philosophers, when they try to justify the human use of animals, are often talking about the situation as if it's one of an emergency. Let's look at life or death, either the animal's life or mine. And Gary Francione's point is that is rarely the case. Most of the time, the house is not on fire. You don't have to decide between your child or the dog. And yet we treat every single instance of the use of animals as if it were some kind of a life-threatening emergency in which if we don't use the animals, we're all going to die. And it's just not the case. And he says something very interesting, which is, look, if the house is really on fire and you really only can save your child or the dog, you might well save your child. But that would have not so much a moral basis or motivation as what he calls a psychological or emotional one, which is you might just relate more immediately to your child because of things like shared language and so forth. I mean, let's face it, I love my cat Pindar very, very dearly, but the fact that we cannot communicate in human language poses challenges and obstacles for me in my endeavor to understand him. And as you were alluding to before, I'm willing to say that may well be at least as much a deficiency in me as it is in him.
That's a good point. You know? Well, people often use distracting techniques to get us off the point of what we're talking about. What we're talking about here is eliminating pain and suffering, that it is not morally appropriate to cause pain and suffering to sentient beings, that factory farming of animals for food is bad for the environment, it's bad for our health, it's bad, bad, bad. And so when people come along and say, yeah, but don't plants feel pain?
You know, have you seen some of these things in the New York Times over the last 3 or 4 years?
Yes.
Since I published in November of 2009 this op-ed piece in the New York Times, the Sunday before Thanksgiving, Animal, Vegetable, Miserable, since then there have been at least 3 articles in which different writers have made this move about, well, don't plants feel pain? Or how can you say that animals are morally significant and plants are not? And so Natalie Angier did one, and Carol Yoon did one, and most recently Michael Martyr, who is publishing a book this year with my publisher, Columbia University Press, and it's on plant ethics. And he had a little piece in this philosophy section of the opinion page of the New York Times called The Stone in the last, I don't know, 5-6 weeks, in which he's kind of a précis of the book, and it's this argument that, look, there's all kinds of interesting signs of communication in plants. And he was talking about a certain type of pea pod that communicates drought conditions to the other pea pod plants in the area. And therefore, we're being a little bit glib if we think that animals have moral status and that plants don't. How can you make that kind of arbitrary distinction? And my thinking on that has always been, yeah, and the electric eye in my garage door opener sees when there's a tricycle in the doorway. Therefore, it has moral status. It just doesn't make any sense at all. You know, there's a difference between response and reaction. And reaction is something that happens in a completely non-conscious, non-sentient way. There's no evidence whatsoever that plants have any kind of conscious awareness of anything. They don't have central nervous systems. They don't have nociceptors or pain receptors. There's, you know, can I categorically, logically prove that they don't have sentience? And the answer is no. But there's absolutely no reason to suppose that it's any more likely that plants have sentience than that rocks do.
Yeah, it's... And even if they did, by eating only plants and not animals, we're inflicting pain on far fewer plants, because many, many plants have to be grown to feed animals, to feed people, and it's inefficient, it's energy intensive.
It's a very interesting point that I was asked to address in the Animals and the Limits of Postmodernism book that'll be out this fall. The question was, what would it be like to make a worldwide shift to veganism? Wouldn't that be economically and environmentally disastrous?
Oh, it would be beautiful heaven on earth.
Well, look, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've read a lot of I'm not an agronomist. I don't know, but I've read a lot of different estimates of how many pounds of plant protein it takes, or grain it takes, to produce 1 pound of beef. And I've read anything. I've read anything from 7 to 25 pounds, and then 2,500 gallons of water for 1 pound of beef. So, and it turns out that over half the arable land in North America is grazing land, and that grazing land reduces biodiversity, and there's soil erosion, and there's methane production, and there's all of these horrible, environmentally devastating things. That if these 53 billion animals, I mean, that's what is that? That's something like almost 9 times the world population or something like that, or 7 times. It's many, many times the world population. That's every year they're being raised and killed. I can only imagine that things would be a lot better environmentally if we didn't do those things, not to mention the fact that I think it's an encroachment upon a basic natural right that animals have not to be killed. You know, my attitude is, maybe in a life and death face-to-face confrontation, you're entitled to, you know, defend yourself with deadly force. But that my guess is that probably nobody listening to this radio program right now is ever going to be in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I sometimes get somebody calling me or emailing me angrily saying, well, as a matter of fact, I am in that situation, or I was in that situation. I had one person after the op-ed piece leave me a very incensed phone message at work saying that she is highly allergic to plant estrogen and therefore she has to eat animal products in her diet. Now, I don't know medically whether that's the case. If it were, you know, maybe there's a justification for that, but my point is that I don't think that many, if any, of the people who read my work or are in a position to make an intelligent decision about these things really is in that kind of a position.
Right. Okay, we just have a few more minutes before we take a break, and I wanted to ask you about your work at Bucknell University. So you teach philosophy.
Yes.
Do you have an opportunity to share these thoughts with your students, and does the administration have an opinion on that?
The administration has been surprisingly supportive, and they have given me an alarming amount of freedom throughout my career to do whatever I want, almost whatever I want in my teaching, and I've been encouraged and remunerated to develop courses, and I'm teaching just this fall, for example, I'm teaching three courses, two of which bear directly upon animals. One of them is, actually all three of these courses this fall will. One's an introductory course for incoming first-year students on philosophy and literature, and there's a lot of stuff about animals in there, including J.M. Coetzee's work. I'm teaching an introductory philosophy course called Gods, Humans, and Animals, where we're going to read Gary Francione's Introduction to Animal Rights and another book. And I'm also teaching a whole course, intermediate-level course called Western Perspectives on Animals.
Nice. Well, I think it's really important that it's, everybody know what's going on and think about these things, because it's been in the shadows for way too long.
It's true, and it's a niche subject. It's an uphill battle, right?
Well, when I was at Bucknell a long time ago, we actually had a vegetarian meal plan. It wasn't vegan, but it was vegetarian, and I don't think they have one anymore. But they were kind of ahead of their time at that time.
I think there are some vegetarian options in the dining room, but it's certainly not a basic focus. And just giving the overwhelming emphasis on the consumption of animal products in our society, it's not economically appealing to them to do that. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Lamentably.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's take a break, and then we're going to invite Sue Koh to join us.
Great.
So stay with us. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and we're back. You're listening to It's All About Food. And I'm here with Gary Steiner in the studio. He is a professor of philosophy at Bucknell University and an author on a number of books about animals and the moral community. And now I want to invite Sue Koh to join us. She was born in England and grew up next to a slaughterhouse. She studied at the Royal College of Art in London and emigrated to New York in 1972. Early in her career, she was featured in almost every issue of Art Spiegelman's groundbreaking magazine, Raw, and has since contributed illustrations to The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Nation, and Entertainment Weekly, Time, Details, Village Voice, Newsweek, Rolling Stone, Esquire, and Mother Jones, among other publications. She is widely regarded as one of the best and most scathing artists of her time. Her paintings have been exhibited in galleries and museums around the world, including the Museum of Modern Art. Her previous books include Dead Meat, How to Commit Suicide in South Africa, X, and Pitt's Letter. She currently lives in a small cabin in upstate New York that she converted into a solar-powered sustainable home built largely from recycled materials. Welcome to It's All About Food, Sue.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me. I am so honored to have you on the show today. I have read your book, Cruel, and I'm going to try and talk about it, but it's difficult because there's so many issues in here. Oh, we got another guest on the show.
Yes, I have three pit bulls, so don't bark, pit bulls.
Okay, well, we welcome their comments at any time. I wish we could understand them, actually. We were just talking about that. Sue, I read a lot of books about veganism, the importance of being a vegan, how it impacts health and environment and animals. And but many of them don't really get to me because I've read all of the information over and over and over. And yeah, I've read about the 50 plus billion animals in factory farms. And after you read all these numbers, somehow we get a little numb to it. I mean, I continue my work because it's very important, but I read your book and I want to tell you, it got to me. And, it's incredible on so many levels. I want to say I love it, but that's not really the great, the right way to describe my feelings
about it.
Well,
that's very kind of you. I just can't do that sort of numerical research. The numbers seem just so overwhelming to me. And, you know, I'm living here in the woods, and a few feet away are two dairy farms.
Mm.
So I can hear, you know, as we're speaking, I mean, we might be able to hear a calf that's been torn away from the mother, where the cow will cry for 3 days solid. I mean, that's the reality. It's not, I think those numbers are very important. But I'm just overwhelmed with them. And every time I try and do a book, I just can't do it well enough. I can't do those numbers well enough.
Well, I think what you do is beyond numbers, and that's why it's so important. But first, I want to say I know that I'm just going to be teary-eyed during this whole half hour. One of the things that I have difficulty doing is reading about factory farming and watching the videos, and because when I open that my heart up to that information,
yeah.
I hear those cries. I hear them. And so really hard to talk about it.
I know, but could I just suggest something, which is we don't talk about factory farming.
Sure.
It's all factory farming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that if we get into, I mean, I'm just learning about this now, that I think if we use factory farming, the implication is that the small family farm is okay. It is not. Anything that is about animal agriculture is very wrong.
Very wrong.
And I think that's just the way then we're going to get into the locavore movement, and we're going to get into the, you know, labeling some things are more humane, the minuscule manipulations we can do about cruelty. And I don't think we need to enter that. I think what we need to deal with is we don't need animals to live. And there's very precious words like compassion, humane, protection, and care. And these words are being debased by part of the meat industrial complex that's suggesting it can be humane. And I think this one thing, as they are a dominant voice, and we're a tiny voice, even though your voice sounds extremely strong, their dominant voice is sending the message that this is okay to eat other animals, when it's absolutely not.
It's not.
The mass of people are ready to hear a vegan message, not a mixed message, but the vegan message, that you don't need animal products to be healthy.
I wanted to say one more thing, and then I want to get right back to this, because this is really the crux of it all. But this thing about talking about big numbers, that's so overwhelming and people can't comprehend it. But what we can comprehend is when we look at your pictures, and these images are incredible, and you see all of the way you've done so many of them, you can see the magnitude, you can see so many animals, it's just overwhelming. But visually, I think it's easier to understand the magnitude of it.
Well, even if you're an artist, you try and draw 50 different cows or 50 different sheep, that's exhausting drawing 50, and they're all different characters and different personalities. If you go to a sanctuary and you start drawing them, they'll lean against you and you feel their jaws, and you smell the sweet breath of hay. Each one is so individual and different. And just to draw 50, let alone 50 billion, is almost impossible. So that's where, you know, we need to look at the eyes on the one sheep, or all the animals I've seen in the slaughterhouse, which is only a tiny drop of all the animals' blood that's being massacred, is that they've looked at me. Many of those animals have made eye contact with my eyes, and what they say, and I've said this in the book, what they say, and it's as clear as if they're writing in English in giant letters, is, why are you doing this to me?
Yep.
That's what they're saying.
I've seen that. I've heard that. Yeah.
Any species has an idea of justice.
Sue,
you
this
know,
is...
for them to survive as a group, they have justice within their group. And to do that to them is an abomination. They know it's not justice, and they don't understand.
Sue, this is Gary Steiner. I am really pleased to be on the program together with you, and I was looking at your book here while we were talking, and there's a big direct connection between my work, which is more sort of detached and theoretical, and your work, which is exactly this idea that, that one has to see the kinship between human and non-human animals. And there's a real power, especially in the visual representations. It's powerful and very upsetting. And I think people really need to be jarred out of their detachment. And all the theorizing in the world is great, but it's not going to change anybody's heart about these things until they recognize, I think, exactly what you just said, which is that animals are making an appeal to us. They're asking, why are you doing this to me? And they're absolutely helpless at our hands.
They have voices, and their voices, it's like, you know, monks, I mean, this is an art talk. Thank you for saying what you just said. Monk did the scream. You remember that image?
Absolutely.
And it's actually called, he called it the cry of nature. And it was something so loud to him as he crossed that bridge when he made the scream woodcut in the painting. Next door to the mental hospital where his sister was incarcerated was the municipal slaughterhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And they said you could hear the screams of the patients and the animals.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason Monk was crossing that bridge was to go to the mental hospital to visit his sister. And although we cannot prove it, I think when he said the scream of nature, that's what he meant,
mm-hmm.
that he could hear it. And I think if we open up our hearts to hear this cry, animals are speaking for themselves.
And you have a representation in the book that uses that title, don't you?
Karen Davis, who I think is just like this genius. And I've never met her, so it's not personal.
United Poultry Concerns, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I've read her work, and I think she's absolutely a great leader of the animal liberation movement. And she said, oh, why don't you do this? A scream, the chicken in the enriched cages screaming. And I started to research the scream. So that's her thinking. You know, because she's so profoundly, you know, she researches and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that's a brilliant idea because in the enriched cage, so-called enriched cage, you know, when you start to talk about these this legislation, it just poisons your brain to even discuss this. So I'm sorry to even bring this up. But the enriched cage, the fear level for the hen in enriched or regular battery cages is identical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so do they care if they've got a bit more plastic furniture in their cage if the fear level is
right.
identical?
You're talking about a few more square inches to move around in.
Yes. And I think, you know, when you travel around the country, which you probably do, people are ready to hear this. Vegan, don't do this anymore. They're not. You can't get into the nuances of humane slaughtering and gas chambers are more humane.
Mm-hmm.
That's Orwellian insanity.
Well, you talk about that certainly in the book, and you refer to Temple Grandin, and she's certainly gotten a lot of press and made us all feel a little better about what we're doing mm-hmm. because she has this special innate talent or something because of her autism where she can tell mm-hmm. whether animals are feeling better or worse in different situations, and somehow we allow ourselves to believe that it's okay.
My answer to that, which is a very simple answer, is on YouTube. There is video of gassing, it's CO2 gassing of hogs, done, I think it's in Sweden. You can watch this video for 90 seconds, and you can watch these hogs climb the walls in vertical climbing,
mm-hmm.
like magic, to get out of there as they're slowly being suffocated, they're slowly being gassed to death. And the seconds tick off, you know, this is a window into a gas chamber. There's nothing. I mean, that's all I can say in response to Temple Grandin. Her solution in her paper to do with gassing hogs is that these are the wrong breed of pigs. Those pigs in those gas chambers suffered more because they're the wrong breed. So she's a sort of fix-it person. You know, that's the essence. But there's also autistic people writing about, if you love animals, don't kill them. She's not the only voice.
That's true.
It's just the meat industry's convenience that they've made her the only voice. There are as many voices in the autistic community as in any community, and some animal liberation rights people within that community, too.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've often thought about this. You know, Temple Grandin's great claim to fame is having designed more humane slaughterhouses, mm-hmm. more humane means and situations mm-hmm. for killing sentient beings that we have absolutely no need to kill, who pose no threat to us, who have every bit as much of a right to life as we have. And as you say, this is what my friend Gary Francione, who's a law professor mm-hmm. at Rutgers, calls happy meat, the happy meat campaign. It just makes us feel better about exploiting animals.
You know, Gary was so right all those years ago.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He was so right.
The lone voice, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, why didn't I listen to him?
You know, and it goes on and on, Sue. Now we have, you know, Jonathan Safran Foer telling us we should be concerned about animals, but he's not arguing that killing animals is ultimately a bad thing. And
I know
Michael
that.
Pollan, and you know, it just goes on and on. And you were saying earlier that you think that people are ready for this vegan message.
Yes.
Do you think that I mean, I feel so conflicted about that, and I feel such opposition from so many people on this. Could you say a little bit more about what you think about that when you say you think people are ready for this message?
Could I just respond a little bit to what you said before?
Oh, please.
When we're discussing Temple Grandin, in terms of hog slaughter, yes, absolutely. They are better going in six at a time and not single-file system, which is how all slaughterhouses have been designed since Ford car manufacturing. It's called single line.
Mm.
Yes, they are better going six at a time, but a friend of mine that just got into a slaughterhouse in Canada, where they have the gas chambers for hogs, because they've just got the gas chambers, but the hogs are still going in the single line system, which means, in case people don't understand that completely, is the hogs will try and back up, and they will do everything they can
yes.
to climb out of that single file. In that process, they're electrocuted in the eye, you know, which is the most sensitive part, as it would be on us, where they're cattle prodded to keep them going in the single line system. So the net result of humane manipulation is double the torture. This is why when animal protectionists get involved with this, they should be very careful, because the meat industry is only about making a profit. And if they can add on gas chambers, which of course is cheaper because it's six at a time, to a single line system, then yes, they will. And that's why I think it's incredibly naive, or something worse, for animal protectionists to be involved in this type of manipulation of the meat industry, or presumed manipulation of the meat industry. The second part of your question... as I travel a lot, you know, giving talks about art mostly, and it's not to animal rights activists, it's to communities, just regular people in those communities. And I used to say factory farming's wrong, and then we'd all discuss it. And the number one question wasn't even a question. This was 10 years ago. It's, I'm going to quit eating animal products right now. Now the number one question I get is it okay to eat humanely raised animal products? Which, of course, I say no. So now I've sort of stepped it up a bit, and I say it's not okay to eat any animal from small, large, factory farm, anything. And people get it. And I think they get it. It may be I'm just overgeneralizing, but we can't take back all our work of 20 years. We've been educating for 20 years now, and people are finally getting it. Even the New York Times gets it.
Mm-hmm.
So if the New York Times is more radical than animal protectionists, what does that say? Why are we walking back on a message that we've struggled for 2 decades?
Well, this is really important, and I think I'm learning something right here in terms of how I do my activism, and I think I'm going to be changing a few things. But one of the things that Gary's come up with in his new book that's coming out is a phrase that he's coined, the vegan imperative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you're talking about as well. It's not just this vegan lifestyle of, you know, fun food that's healthy mm-hmm. and good for the mm-hmm. environment. It's bigger mm-hmm. than that.
Yes. I mean, I want to read the book, but I think when you say, well, head of Whole Foods is a vegan, so that's supposed to mean something to me. Right, like McKay's head of
yeah.
Whole Foods.
Yeah.
The farmer down below here, the retired farmer, that I can see his little house from sitting here talking to you on the phone, he's also a vegan because he's had 10 heart attacks. And he can't eat the produce that he creates, which is dairy.
Mm. He's a vegan, but he's still producing milk.
His son is.
Okay.
But he said, oh, sir, I can't eat this stuff anymore, and I love it. I'm a vegan like you.
Well, there's plenty of meat at Whole Foods, too, right, Sue?
Exactly. See, this is what I'm saying. Is being a vegan is about other things other than what you put in your mouth. It's about social justice. This is a social justice movement. It's not about consumer choice. Go, Gary, go.
It's about how to live.
Yes.
It's about how you live your life and what you believe in, the principles that you stand for, and whether you believe in true nonviolence. That's,
yes.
to me, what it's about.
Thank you.
You've got, I just, there's just so many amazing pictures in here, but I'm thumbing through and I'm looking at the picture of the little chick who's been debeaked and then the picture of the guy who's doing the debeaking. And people need to see this, even in this format where it's not a real photograph, but just to understand that these things are going on. I don't think most people have a clue.
No, they don't, because it's hidden from them. It's concealed.
So where do you get the models for most of your drawings? Because, like you said, most of it is concealed.
Well, I'm trying to get into decompression facilities now, which we didn't discuss. We discussed gassing hogs. Mm-hmm. We didn't discuss decompression of chickens, which is fairly new to this country. That will be hard for me to get access to. But what I...
Can you explain what that is?
Oh, it's where... it's like the bend. So chickens, instead of being electrocuted, water bath, or probably nothing, because chickens don't have any humane slaughter rights, it's just throat cut exsanguination one at a time. Now they can go into this giant tube, which is like a decompression tube, and slowly be decompressed. Which the first thing that happens with a chicken, they have very sensitive ears, their eardrums rupture. And this, again, I think could be 90 seconds. 90 seconds is a very long time
mm-hmm.
to die,
mm-hmm.
but this is considered more humane.
So they're essentially exploded.
Yes.
Or imploded.
Or imploded.
Yeah, that's it. That's a better way to say it. And I think, you know, so my intent is to get in with a paper and pencil. You know, when I give talks and stuff, there's always a slaughterhouse worker in the audience or a brother or sister of a slaughterhouse worker. They say, I'll get you into a slaughterhouse. No mm-hmm. problem. And I say, okay, good. When then? And so that happens all the time. And because I'm going in there with a pencil and paper, people can see what I'm doing. I'm not stealing anything. I'm not taking away anything. If they want the drawings, they can have them. And as long as I don't depict workers as monsters, which I'd never do anyway, although sometimes I have done that, I have to admit.
But I see a few monsters in some of these pictures.
Right. There's a couple there in shark fishing. But they can have a portrait of themselves, and if it's inaccurate or I've done anything wrong, then I'll change it, and it won't ever see the light of day. So those people on the staff in slaughterhouses are very concerned about losing their jobs. They're very concerned. That's the only job they could get. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be attacked by animal rights activists. And so, you know, they see me and we talk about, we just talk about politics or whatever they want to talk about. Most likely they're going to be Spanish speaking. And then, you know, I give them a drawing. And then they can look at the drawings and they say, well, is this equipment wrong? Did I get that wrong? Or, you know, anywhere down on these farms I can go and draw. I know these guys. And so I can go and draw. And they just look at it and say, oh, that's good. You could be a court reporter.
That's amazing.
It doesn't have evil intent. It's just to draw what goes on. And if they don't like it, they can have the drawings and I can leave with no drawings.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. That's brilliant.
Well, I think one of the most powerful things, as I said at the beginning, about these drawings is they're so evocative. And Sue, you mentioned Munch's The Scream. I think one of the things that makes that such a famous and treasured image is, or set of images, because as we know there are a number of them, is mm-hmm. that they have a real claim on people's souls. And that's what I think is really needed more than just a lot of words or statistics, as you said, but something that will really get people to look animals in the eye and take them as if they're looking at themselves when they look at an animal.
Exactly. You know, there's this great photographer in Canada, she's called Joanne, and you can find her work on Toronto Pig Save. It's called Toronto Pig Save. Just if anyone's interested, they Google that. And these are some of the greatest photographs of what they're doing up there in Toronto is they're witnessing animals going into a slaughterhouse. And it is the most powerful set of photographs you'll ever see. And it's the last view, like Joanne's got her camera in through the slats of the hog transport and how they're looking back at her. And it's so poignant. And the last sight they see, and so it started out with one woman just witnessing, and this woman called Anita, who's so in advance, you know, in terms of animal activism, she's so advanced. It's the same with Karen. You know, this is happening all over the world. I'm just talking about her. And so she started this movement called Toronto Pig Save, where people in the local community take responsibility for living next door to a slaughterhouse. Instead of denying it's there, they're starting to stand outside and just stand there. And that slows down the staff in the slaughterhouse. It slows down the truck drivers. It makes them start to engage with the people standing there. And it's a very powerful thing they've done. And now they're getting 20 or 40 a day. And these are neighbors.
I love that story. You know, that's one of the problems today is people feel so overwhelmed and so powerless, but we are all responsible and we all need to take responsibility. And even if it's just standing outside of a place and something that we don't condone, we have to take a stand. We can't just sit back, watch TV, look at the internet and complain. We need to take responsibility.
Yeah, we're so isolated when we do that. You know, just sitting in front of a piece of plastic, you know, plasma something. But when you go out and do that witnessing, when it started off with one woman, she's not alone anymore because then there were two women and then there were two women and a guy and then there were more. And so they're not witnessing something in isolation and despair. They're witnessing something as a community.
That's so important, community. Sue, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food.
Oh, it's been a pleasure talking to you both.
And I feel like, well, there are no words to explain your book, and I will do my best to get it in the hands of as many people as I can. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Sue Coe and Gary Steiner. Thanks for joining me
today. Thank you, Karen. It's been a great pleasure.
It really has. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Have a delicious week.